DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
From DW Studios in Bonn, this is Living Planet, and I'm Charlotte Lomas. Coming up on the show today, from the hunter to the hunted, we ponder the ethics of breeding blonde wildebeest, why one of the ocean's top hunters, the great white, is in decline, plus the legacy of Chernobyl, hunting for Europe's radioactive boars. That's coming up. Stay tuned. South Africa is a popular destination for tourists hoping to experience animals out in nature. But over the last decade or so, a new industry has developed which is calling the very meaning of the word nature into question. Individual game farmers are breeding all sorts of different colourful versions of the animals, from snow white springbok to golden wildebeest, to sell them to other breeders and trophy hunters. Our reporter Tony Andrews visited a game farm near Cape Town to find out more.
Out in the bush, about an hour's drive east of Cape Town, majestic mountain landscapes collide with rugged beaches. In the midst of this unforgettable scenery, it's easy to see why so many tourists visit the area. I'm at a local game farm today to check out the star attractions, wild animals. Local game farmer Fernando Rueda drives me around his 1,000-hectare property, which is divided into large camps for different animals.
This whole buffalo or just...
No, not really. You know, in there we keep all the bulls. See, there is a buffalo herd right there.
The landscape is dry and craggy. The grass has lost its green vitality. The region's worst drought on record has left only rigid husks and patches of shrubs covering the hillsides. When he first started breeding 4 years ago, Rueda began with just 5 animals. Today, he has over 500, including oryx, buffalo, and sable. But the animals he keeps here are particularly unique.
There you go, there's a golden animal in front of you. It's a golden bull.
That's right, a golden wildebeest. Wildebeest are a kind of antelope commonly found in the open woodlands of Africa. Normally their coat is brown or very dark blue. Back at the farmhouse, Rueda says that the golden variety of wildebeest is so unusual that he can sell it for about 20 or 30 times more than the normal variety. Breeding golden wildebeest, explains Rueda, requires a set of parents that have special colouring to mate.
So a golden female with a golden male, you will always have a golden animal.
He sells some of these animals to other breeders who want to increase their stocks. But most of his customers will ultimately be trophy hunters who want to hang the glossy beasts on their walls. Rueda says he wants to restore the numbers of these unusual animals to their former glory, before humans hunted them.
And you want an animal that looks true to the species. You want it, you know, in the old days, for example, we have been told, I've never seen this, but we have been told that there were buffalo roaming around 60 inches.
60 inches of horn, that is. Besides color variants, Rueda also breeds for size or bulk. He says the biggest buffalo horn we are currently aware of is around 55 inches.
So the idea is to, within a decade, to be able to say, well, we've bred 60-inch animals like they used to roam free at the turn of the 20th century. There are no natural animals of that length left. So by selectively breeding with a bigger bull and a bigger cow, we are hoping you will have a bigger offspring.
Not everyone is thrilled with this practice. Ernst Barth is the executive director for biodiversity support at Cape Nature, a conservation group in the southwest of the country. He says deliberately breeding animals this way is risky.
Selectively breeding for a specific color coat is not necessarily in the best interest of the species or the animal themselves, because it is a recessive gene that now gets perpetuated or promoted, that may come with some defects. In other words, disease resistance might be lower in the offspring and so on and so forth.
So what do hunters make of all this? To find out, I pay a visit to Cape Hunt, an association of affiliated hunting groups. Cape Hunt's CEO is Matt Relihan. Inside his office, the walls are lined with dozens of taxidermied animals staring lifelessly across the room. I ask Relihan what he thinks about genetic manipulation of animals.
I don't think it's natural, and I think there will be some opposition to it from the hunters.
Relihan's organization represents primarily meat hunters, people who kill animals for personal consumption. They make up the majority of the market, more than 250,000 hunters a year. By contrast, there are fewer than 10,000 trophy hunters a year, according to Relihan. And many of them are skeptical of color variants, he adds.
We are very traditionalist in what we do, and we prefer the traditional way of doing things and of hunting. And the animal that we want it to be a natural animal as well.
Other groups, like the South African Hunters and Game Conservation Association, have made official statements condemning the practice. They say selective breeding is harming South Africa's biodiversity, the health of its game, and the country's reputation as a sustainable, responsible hunting destination. Back at his farm, Fernando Rueda disagrees with those who call the practice unnatural.
Maybe they inform themselves a little better. They will understand that it's not man-made. We don't make a golden wildebeest. Nature did it. You know, we don't give a different food to change its color. We don't send it to the hairdresser to make it blonde.
Rueda also says that neither he nor other breeders he knows have witnessed any discrepancies in the animal's immunity levels.
The animal is identical. There is no difference. They're no more susceptible to being sunburned by the sun or different behavior if they don't eat too much. In fact, they are identical animals. I'll take that stance. That there's no one breeder of color variant that would disagree with me that a golden wildebeest is different to a normal blue wildebeest.
Rueda and his managers monitor the animals very closely, daily in fact. Their constant interaction with the animals, however, has prompted further criticism. Ernst Bart says daily feeding and observation, what he calls pampering, is changing the animal's wild nature. As we drive around his farm, Rueda points out several times that these animals in no way seem to be domesticated. As we drive up to a wildebeest, Rueda illustrates his point.
So he keeps running away from us as we get closer.
Yeah, he's a wild animal. Yeah. I told you earlier, you know, he doesn't want you to, you know, he stops and he looks, but he doesn't want to be patted or... And tell you, you get out of the car and try and go and touch one. They will run either towards you, to harm you, or very far away from you.
Rueda shows me some photos of some of the animals he's going to try to sell at an auction coming up in a few days. I ask him how much he's hoping to get for a golden wildebeest.
In this market, anything above 100, 120,000, I'll be happy.
That's around 120,000 rand, the equivalent of almost 9,000 euros. Just 2 years ago, that same animal would have fetched three or four times that price. Value started falling when the country was hit by a severe drought in 2015. As it became more expensive to buy feed, many breeders sold their animals, flooding the market and sending prices in a downward spiral. Rueda says he's not worried about the development, though.
We may change things around a little. If the prices really go down all the way down there, then we may feed them less, farm them more extensively. We'll see. But, I mean, the industry is healthy. It's not. It's going through a slight downturn in prices, but the industry itself is very healthy.
Breeders like Rueda may be able to maneuver around the laws of nature, but the laws of economics are less malleable. And ultimately, it's the price that will determine the future of color variants in the country. If profits slow to a complete halt, the debate over selective breeding may too be over. I'm Tony Andrews for DW in Cape Town, South Africa.
Well, game farms and safaris aside, for other tourists in South Africa, the adrenaline rush of coming face to face with the notorious great white shark is top of their travel agenda. Cage diving is one way to do that, but tour operators running these expeditions are worried. The local great white shark population is becoming so scarce on South Africa's west coast, scientists fear the apex hunters may be dying out. Jan-Philipp Schluter went to find out more, and Ruby Russell presents his report.
We're on subtropical South Africa's west coast, but the Atlantic waters here off Gans Bay never exceed a nippy 14 degrees Celsius.
Oh, okay.
The tour boat's 7 passengers are well protected in neoprene dive suits, but with this much adrenaline, who'd feel the chill anyway? Sitting in a steel cage suspended at the water's surface, they're about to have their first encounter with a great white shark.
So nervous.
Too nervous.
Yeah. Oh.
Among them is Niklas, a 26-year-old student from Cologne in Germany.
I'm fascinated by sharks. Always have been, actually. So I thought, since I'm here in the area, I've got to do this.
For now, the caged divers sit and wait, staring into the water. A stinking brew of fish heads, chopped sardines and fish oil is poured overboard to attract the sharks. But whether the stars of the show turn up or not is down to them, says marine biologist Sarah Andriotti with a grin. She's been researching great whites here at Gans Bay for 7 years now.
They all have different personalities. Some of them get very skittish by the situation, they just leave. Some of them stick around, and these are the ones we can play with. We are making them waste a little bit of time.
Suddenly, the command comes. Put your goggles on, take a deep breath, and dive. And here it is. A great white, nearly 4 meters long, rushes toward the boat, turns elegantly at the last moment, and glides right past the cage, eyeing the shark watchers and flashing sharp triangular teeth.
Remember, the shark's not going to stop the pose for pictures. Good.
It's the first of 4 of the otherworldly giants to make an appearance today. A good turnout by current standards, tour operator Michael Rutzen says with regret.
Before, I think the average that we saw in a day is 7 or 8, and the numbers of sightings have definitely decreased.
46-year-old Rutzen is famous in South Africa as the Shark Man. He spent more time freediving around great whites than anyone, that is, without the safety of the cage. Celebs like Brad Pitt, Leonardo DiCaprio and Prince Harry have all made the journey to dive with him. Rutzen also invests in shark research. Among other things, he's co-financed a population study by Sarah Andriotti from Stellenbosch University. The results are worrying. According to Andriotti, the number of great whites off the South African coast has fallen. Her research confirms what Rutzen and his crew observe daily.
Sarah's work are proving what we're seeing in the field.
We could estimate that we have in between 300 and 500 white shark left around the coastline. What we are worried about is if nothing changes in the pattern we are seeing now, we might see them going.
According to Andriotti, humans are to blame for the shark's decline. It's down to a combination of pollution, illegal hunting, overfishing of the shark's prey, and badly designed shark nets, which are meant to protect swimmers but can ensnare the animals and kill them. If great whites died out here, there would be terrible consequences for the whole food chain, Andriotti says.
White sharks are apex predators. They are keeping balance in the whole ecosystem. Without these species to balance this equilibrium, think about Cape Fur seals. If we won't have apex predators to eat Cape Fur seals, the seal's population is going to increase terribly, dramatically, and they are going to need a lot of fishes to sustain themselves.
Andriotti's study is not without controversy. Marine biologist Alison Koch is at the newly renovated Shark Spotters office at Muizenberg Beach near Cape Town. Shark Spotters keeps watch over several beaches in the area. It's their job to warn surfers when the feared predators are nearby. Koch and her colleagues from the University of Cape Town have reviewed Andriotti's Gans Bay study and question its results.
Previous estimates were between 1 and 2,000 animals, but 500 is a very, very low number, and we just have technical problems with this particular number, and we believe it doesn't represent the entire population.
Still, the scientists agree on one thing. Whether there are 500 great whites off this coast or more than 1,000, they are an endangered species and need greater protection. Andreotti and Rutzen wanted the shark recategorised from endangered to threatened with extinction at the recent World Wildlife Conservation Conference in Johannesburg. But a promotion wasn't on the agenda.
It is my belief that they should have done that. And it's also my belief that if they don't get protection for these animals in the nearby future, white shark cage diving will cease to exist within South African borders.
The loss of these sharks would be a disaster for the delicate ecosystem here. For the human population of Gans Bay, a fishing village and mecca for cage diving, it would also be a huge economic blow. Numerous bed and breakfasts, restaurants and 8 tour operators rely on the business. Without the sharks, plenty of locals would be out of a job. Michael Rutzen's boat bobs gently on the waves as Niklas, the German tourist, climbs out of the cage with a broad grin on his face. He's just been eye to eye with a great white shark, its jaws just centimetres from his face. It's an experience he won't forget anytime soon.
It was really spectacular to see the sharks from so close up, not least because of their huge size. It was majestic.
Ja, sehr majestätisch, kann man schon sagen.
Heard earlier in the show, there's mounting interest in hunting coloured game. But what happens when they're radioactive? Wild boar is a delicacy across much of Europe, and the Czech Republic is no exception. But there's a slight problem with boars shot in the forests in the south of the country. Almost half of them are radioactive. The danger to human health is almost zero. All boars shot in the area are inspected by authorities before the meat is consumed. But it's part of the enduring legacy of Europe's worst nuclear disaster, Chernobyl. Rob Cameron has more from Prague.
Sous chef Jiří Šafářík trimming fat from slabs of wild boar meat here at Kastrol, a restaurant specialising in game on the southwestern fringes of Prague. The menu includes mouth-watering dishes such as deer ragu with roasted pumpkin gnocchi, quarter of roasted duck with red cabbage, bread and potato dumplings, and Kastrol's signature dish, wild boar ragu with rosehip sauce and potato pancakes. The restaurant's owner is Pierre Mem, born in France, educated in Czech schools, who left a career in banking to go into the restaurant business. And just like his sous chef, he loves game.
We are oriented on, modern village food, and the venison is important on that.
Okay.
And use all types of animals.
Including wild boar?
Naturally, including wild boar.
Right.
And so it's the only animal that is hunting during the whole year. The hunting season is 12 months.
So it's important, very important for you as a proprietor, that you, it's very important that you know the origin of meat. And sometimes you even hunt it yourself, is that correct?
Yes. Actually, this is the difference. And I don't want to differentiate myself or our restaurant from the others. But you can buy venison or you can buy game in this country, but 95% is frozen. So I buy it fresh, and I know exactly the age of the animal and the origin, who hunted it. And some of these I do it personally.
Game is a major feature of traditional Czech cuisine. Pierre shoots his wild boar in central Bohemia, far from the affected area. But in the south of the country, in the forest known to Czechs as the Šumava and to Germans as the Böhmerwald, hunters have to go through a laborious process before they can sell or consume wild boar. Jiří Drápal is head of food safety at the State Veterinary Authority in Prague.
The veterinary authority issued a so-called extraordinary veterinary measure, which applies to 7 or 8 hunting grounds within the Šumava National Park. And within these hunting grounds, each wild boar shot here must be set aside and a half kilo sample of meat extracted from it. The samples are sent to Prague. There are daily transports for testing by the State Veterinary Institute.
The boars become radioactive by digging up a fungus called Elaphomyces granulatus, known commonly as Jelenka in Czech and deer balls or false truffles in English. The fungus has an unfortunate ability to absorb high levels of the radioactive isotope cesium-137, which contaminated the Šumava when a cloud of radiation drifted over Central Europe in the wake of the Chernobyl disaster. Cesium-137 has a half-life of 30 years, meaning it takes 30 years for the radioactivity of the isotope to fall to half its original value. So Elaphomyces granulatus and the boars that munch on them will be radioactive for some time. Jiří Drápal explains that this is a seasonal problem. When the winters are short and mild, the boars have enough food and don't need to dig up the mushrooms. When the winters are long and cruel, like this one, food is scarce, so they spend their time foraging for fungi. And therein lies the problem, though he assures me you'd have to eat enormous quantities of radioactive boar to get sick.
You'd have to consume over 40 kilos of contaminated boar meat per year to feel any ill effects at all, which is extremely unlikely. You'd have to have a diet made up almost exclusively of boar meat contaminated with more than 600 becquerels of radioactivity.
The problem isn't new and isn't limited to the Šumava. The authorities over the border in Bavaria have similar rules, though different control mechanisms. In the Czech Republic, only a fraction of boar shot and eaten is hunted in the Šumava, and the animals caught outside it are quite safe. But the laborious testing procedure is certainly a sobering reminder of the consequences of Chernobyl. Rob Cameron, DW, Prague.
To France now, a country that boasts one of the biggest hunting populations in the EU. Some 1 million people are out shooting everything from woodcock to stags during the hunting season. But even in France, the number of hunters is falling steadily. Today, there are only around half the number there were in the 1980s. John Laurenson reports from near the village of Anche, west of Paris, on a very French tradition that is sliding towards extinction.
8 men with guns and hunting horns walk into a wood, spread out in a long line, and wait. Among them, Mathieu Andrew.
I like to look to hear all the noise in the forest. I think I am like an animal, like a prehistoric man. It's in my nature.
Tell me about your hunt last week.
I've seen a stag, but I missed him.
Did you track him for a long time?
Yes. Maybe 3 hours. Yes, I was near. We could smell the animal.
Attention! A deer darts out of the wood, but the angle's risky. If he'd taken a shot, he might have hit the next hunter in the line. France's deer and wild boar populations are on the rise. There are so many of the latter, rooting around in crops, ramming Renault Scenics, that hunters are allowed to shoot pretty much as many as they like. Sometimes the authorities even step in to shoot a few more. But, says the president of the Anche Hunters Association, small game, hare, quail, partridge and woodcock, is another story.
My name is Bernard Poirier. I've been hunting since I was 16. I'm 64 now. I can remember when there were 120 of us. Now we're 28. It's because of intensive farming. They've killed most of the small game, grubbing up hedgerows and creating the massive fields we have now. The hare eat the pellets the farmers put down for the slugs and die, and the partridges are mangled in their machines.
Même le petit gibier, il a pas le temps de démarrer, il est déjà monté dans la machine.
After succeeding in shooting precisely nothing, the Anche hunt takes a break, and I hear about another reason for the decline of the French hunter, the cost. I get talking to a mechanic, a school canteen cook, a bus driver and a chip stand owner who have to pay for a gun, the bullets and the clothes that make you look like you've walked in from an East European war zone, the license and the fee for every animal you kill, up to €300 for a stag. The National Hunters Federation gives me a further reason for the disruption of hunting, people moving from the country to the towns and more generally from place to place. But whatever the cause, an old French tradition, an old French prerogative even, is under threat. Dinner table appreciation for the brace of rock partridges that were my father's glory in the film taken from the book by that name by one of France's best-loved novelists, Marcel Pagnol. Guy de Maupassant wrote enthusiastically about hunting too. So did Albert Camus. Each would have been keenly aware that the common people's right to hunt was the first won from the nobility by the French Revolution. Now, though, hunting's opponents are on the rise. No hunters, shout demonstrators in front of the Senate, the upper house of the French Parliament, where I meet François Darlot, president of France Without Hunting, a pressure group that hopes that France will follow the lead of Switzerland's Geneva Canton, which banned hunting back in 1974. Bit by bit, he says, we're getting there.
Things have changed a lot since my father's day. He was a farmer and a hunter at a time, about 50 years ago, when France had 2.5 million hunters. Now the Hunters Federation says there are 1.2 million, but they do a bit of double counting, and it's really 960,000. The main reason for the decline is that our values have changed. We have so much more sensibility now when it comes to the animal world.
Back out with the Anche hunters, a small group this time, searching a field of wet rapeseed for hare, partridge and pheasant. One of the hunters, Christophe Potier, is the first Frenchman I've seen in a good long while who wears a beret. His dog puts up a partridge, he aims, fires and brings it down. It struggles on the ground for a moment before his dog finishes it off and brings it to its master, a beautiful bird, still warm. One of the things Christophe's hunting friend Mathieu told me in that wood the previous day was that a generation or two ago, French country dwellers were able to kill a chicken without thinking twice about it. Not anymore. But Christophe is more old school, and he's got plans for his partridge. I'm going to pluck it and cook it, he says. Roast it probably with mushrooms. John Lawrenson, DW, Anche, France.
And that wraps up the show for this week. For more, just download the Living Planet podcast on iTunes, listen to us on SoundCloud, or visit our website, dw.com/environment. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at DW Environment. Thanks to our studio team, Eliana Giaducci and Yaron Kut. I'm Charlotte Lomas. Catch you next week.
Dans une banlieue surpeuplée, on habite un meublé. Elle et moi, la fenêtre n'a qu'un carreau qui donne sur l'entrepôt. Et les toits, on va pas à Saint-Paul-de-Vence, on passe toutes nos vacances à Saint-Ouen. Comme Fanny, on n'a qu'une marraine, quelque part en Lorraine, et c'est loin. Maman, elle a 25 berges, et je crois bien que la Sainte Vierge des églises n'a pas plus d'amour dans les yeux et ne sourit pas mieux, quoi qu'on dise. Le soir, quand la ville s'ensommeille chez nous y'a du soleil qui s'attarde. Je pose ma tête sur ses reins, je prends doucement sa main et je la garde. On se raconte les choses qui nous viennent, c'est beau comme du Verlaine, on dirait. On regarde tomber le jour et puis on fait l'amour en secret.